I'm John Krall. Today is World AIDS Day, a moment when we are supposed to take stock of where we are in the fight against HIV and commemorate those who have died. More than 30 million people around the globe live with HIV/AIDS, and every year between 1.5 million and 2 million die. Here in Indiana, more than 10,000 Hoosiers live with the disease. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk about the toll AIDS has taken on Indiana and the world with our guests, Dr. Danielle Osterholzer of the IU School of Medicine, Damien Center Executive Director Tom Bartenbach, and a client of the Damien Center, and you. Please join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are marking on No Limits today World AIDS Day. We are fortunate to have as our guests Tom Bartenbach, who is the executive director of the Damien Center. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon.
It's good to have you here. We also have with us Dr. Danielle Osterholzer, faculty member with the IU School of Medicine and medical director of the Ryan White HIV Clinic at Wishart Hospital. Dr. Osterholzer, good to have you here.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. We also are fortunate to have with us Phil, who is a volunteer and client of the Damien Center. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
We're going to talk about AIDS in Indiana, but I really also would like to talk about the global situation. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. They also could send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. So I want to start first just by asking, really, how much progress have we made? We were talking before we went on the air about the fact that we are now in the fourth decade of this fight. Dr. Osterholzer, how much progress has been made in that time?
Well, you know, initially, as everyone knows, when the disease was first discovered and in the initial, you know, decade of the infection, we spent a lot of time taking care of people who were dying. And now, those of us who provide HIV care feel that HIV has now become more of a chronic illness. We are able to treat HIV effectively. There are still a lot of issues that go along with being HIV infected, but it has now kind of turned more into a chronic illness, at least in the United States. Certainly that's not the case in sub-Saharan Africa, mm-hmm. and other areas of the world, but we have made significant progress in treatment in the United States. As far as prevention and new infections, we still have not made a huge impact in improving that, even in the United States. So we're still seeing over 50,000 new infections every year in the United States, and that has not gone down in the last several decades.
So, yeah, that's a decent-sized city,
yeah.
Basically, every
yeah.
year gets infected. What's the mortality rate now?
It depends on someone's access to medical care and whether they take HIV medications or not. There are some papers that have tried to run mathematical models to try to predict how long someone might survive with HIV infection. I think people who are diagnosed fairly early, who get on HIV medications and take them, can expect to live well into adulthood, mm-hmm. Definitely into their 40s, 50s, or even 60s. But individuals who are diagnosed late, who have severe immune suppression, who have severe illness, may not be able to, you know, live as long. So it depends on access to medications and how far advanced the disease is when it becomes diagnosed.
Tom Bartenbach, could you tell me a little bit about what the Damien Center does and then how many people you work with?
Well, the Damien Center was established in 1987 on a collaborative effort by the Episcopal Church here in Marion County as well as the Roman Catholic Church. We are located over on Pennsylvania. We currently have 1,200 active clients that we see in the clinic in the center over on Arsenal. We are an independent agency, a United Way agency. We provide services primarily around non-medical issues around food pantry, employment activity. 65% of our clients are unemployed. We have 70% living in poverty. We're seeing an enormous increase in women with HIV. Actually, a third of our clients are women, and 85% of those were infected by heterosexual contact. We also do testing. In the center, we have an outreach program that reaches teen and adolescent youth. Mm-hmm. We're still very active in the gay community in terms of condom distribution and education prevention.
Where does your funding come from, by and large?
We get a lot of funding from United Way, as well as being a United Way agency, as well as Ryan White's funding from the federal dollars that are distributed around the country, as well as local donors, private organizations, and individuals. We fortunately have an amazing partnership with the Indiana State Department of Health. Mm-hmm. Sean Carney's been doing that job for probably 20 years, as well as Dr. Virginia Kane with the Marion County Health Department. She's been actively involved with HIV. I know that's a cause that's dear to her heart. The Indiana AIDS Fund, a lot of partners in the city, along with Riley Hospital, St. Vincent's. Those are the challenges that we're coming up with when you talk about funding, mm-hmm. As we try to reach populations that are becoming infected, that the stigma is still very high.
How large is your budget annually?
$2.5 million.
$2.5 million, and you have to serve 1,200 people?
That's right.
Annually with that?
That's right, and we're about 86% to services.
Explain what that means, please.
Well, it's 14% goes to administrative overhead.
Okay, so basically to pay the people to do the work, it's 14%, but 86% goes to help people like Phil.
That's
directly.
Correct.
And Phil, can you tell me a little bit about your story? I presume, obviously, you're living with HIV.
I am. I'll be as brief as I can, but it's kind of a long story. I'd always gotten tested on a pretty regular basis, and in April of 2005, I went to get tested. Just on a routine basis, I'd gotten to know the lady who did the testing on a pretty familiar basis, and we chit-chatted and laughed and carried on every time I go in on that regular basis. And in April of 2005, I went in and then went back. At that time, it was unlike it is now. You went back 2 weeks later, and you found out what your results were. So I went back,
where were you tested, if I could ask real quick?
It was at a downtown location.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Please continue your story. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's all right.
I was going to give you a chance to give the Damien Center a plug.
Oh, no, didn't happen to be there, but obviously I've crossed their path recently.
Yeah.
The last time I was there was April 26th of 2005. And we did the same thing as normal, you know, how you doing, da-da-da-da-da, and she was laughing, and she looked at me in the eye, and the smile vanished from her face, and she said, "Honey, I've got some bad news for you." Mm-hmm. And from there, in the following year, I would say maybe in the following 6 months, I went from despair, loneliness, distraught, panic attacks, and so it finally digressed into a situation where I was seriously very close. It's hard to tell in retrospect how close you are if you don't do it, but very close to suicide. Oh. And I was given a Macy's type sack of stuff, paraphernalia, pamphlets and stuff. And so occasionally I'd look into that bag, and one of them had a little pamphlet on the Damien Center. And I guess maybe just as a reaching out, I thought, well, what the heck, I'll just call him. And so the rest is kind of history from then on. I went in to see them and was directed to some psychiatric help and other help, and today I can honestly say that I'm here because of the Damien Center.
We are talking about AIDS in Indiana to mark World AIDS Day. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or send us an email, nolimits@wfyi.org. Send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter @WFYI. Phil, I want to continue a little more with this. You know, in some ways, and I mean no disrespect to Tom Bartenbach or Daniel Osterholzer here, the real experience here, though, is what communicates, and you're living with this. Did you break the news to family, friends,
no,
loved ones?
No, I did not. So, and still have not.
Still have not? So no one, which is the reason, I might add, that we're not using your last name on the program. So no one, you basically had to go and deal with this all by yourself.
Yes. As I began to get, I guess, relatively comfortable with the situation, I did disclose this to a few friends, which happens to be a situation that makes a situation like the Damien Center's presence even more important, because I think we all need, in a time like that, a place to reach out to, if nothing else than just a rope to grab onto.
And how long did it take you? You said you got to a comfortable. How long was that process? How long did it?
It was a long, long time. I don't notice I'm comfortable with it now, but I would say to where I felt like I was attacking this virus rather than reacting to it, I would say it's probably about 2 years.
Okay, and 2 years of despair, basically.
Oh yeah, yes. Increase of medication, antidepressants, the whole deal. Yes.
Why are you? And I'm not saying this in a challenging way, but I think people need to hear that. Why didn't you want to share this with family or friends or coworkers?
Well, first of all, it was a shame situation, and possibly the stigma, as we all talk about. And you know, I think it's probably maybe the misunderstanding that everyone has. This doesn't happen to people like me. Mm-hmm. You don't get stuff like this.
Well, and I want to pick up on this idea of the stigma. Tom Bartenbach, could you talk about what the stigma is attached to being diagnosed with HIV?
Sure. Well, John, when you go back in the history, this was certainly a gay disease,
They called it the gay plague.
The gay plague. We certainly bought all the connotations of taboo. I always used to think that. That AIDS bought gay out of the closet and put us out on the street. That stigma still exists today because of the rising number of heterosexual women and men that are testing positive, who are having challenges with the disease within themselves becoming public because they don't want to be seen as homosexual. There's somehow that's still that religious connotation tied to it is... all the negative flowers that go around that one are weeds. But, you know, when Phil was talking about his struggles with the disease, if you think of a time back in the day when we used to make love and death at the same time, and it was literally possible to die of love. Mm-hmm. And that's a continuum of mindset that has been hard to break out of even today. The stigma is still rapidly high in the churches. You know, that we see the country is still very polarized on so many issues, and this isn't one that they've come into embrace. Complacency is also another problem in communities that know they are infected, know they're at risk.
In the interest of disclosure, my wife is a journalist as well and was a reporter in Alabama and did a story about the fact that a lot of high school students down there were showing an alarming incidence of being infected because they were so afraid within that community of getting pregnant. And so they were engaging in all sorts of unprotected sex and high-risk unprotected sex that exposed them instead to something deadly. We are talking about AIDS in Indiana today here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. We are talking with our guests, Tom Bartenbach, Executive Director of the Damien Center, Dr. Danielle Osterholzer, and Phil, a client of the Damien Center. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are marking World AIDS Day here on the show and talking about AIDS in Indiana. We're fortunate to have as our guest Tom Bartenbach, Executive Director of the Damien Center, Phil, who is a client of the Damien Center, and Dr. Danielle Osterholzer, faculty member with the IU School of Medicine and medical director of the Ryan White HIV Clinic at Wishard Hospital. I want to get an email question in real quickly. It's from someone who doesn't want his or her name used on the air. It says, "Forgive me for not wanting my name used on the air, but I have a question for your panel. I am a member of the oldest continuously functioning HIV plus PWA support group in Indiana. In fact, because we had dwindled to four and the other three dropped out this year, I am the last member. Unless I can locate persons who this style of support group can help and recruit them. I do not want 20-plus years of history, expertise, and help to end with me. Do you believe that there are still people who need ACET face meeting weekly meetings in this internet age to help them through the hardships of being HIV positive and having AIDS?" Face-to-face, sorry, I misread there was a typo. It's probably face-to-face meetings. Tom Bartenbach.
We certainly provide support groups within the center.
If this person wanted to get in touch with you, how should he or she do this?
They can call the center at 317-632-0123.
Give that number again real quickly.
317-632-0123, or go to our website, Damien.org, D-A-M-I-E-N.org.
Okay. Dr. Osterholzer, I'd like to talk a little bit about what people can do to protect themselves from HIV infection. What steps should they take?
Sure. Well, you know, I'd say the biggest way that people can protect themselves is to use condoms, which, you know, has been discussed for years during the HIV epidemic. You know, we also recommend frequent testing. So, you know, Phil was going to get tested frequently, and that was very responsible of him. You know, knowing your status helps you protect other people. So frequent testing is something that we recommend. The CDC actually recommends that every individual age 13 to 64 get tested for HIV at least once in their life. And for people who perceive themselves to be at higher risk, to get tested every year. So we know that...
Who are the folks who are at higher risk?
I'd say people who have maybe had unprotected sex partners, who have engaged in intravenous drug use, maybe have had other sexually transmitted diseases that they've been diagnosed with. Really, it's hard to know. I mean, everyone is at risk if they have any sexual activity at all. It just takes one time with someone who's infected to become infected yourself. So, you know, I think people who are sexually active, especially if they're outside of monogamous relationships, should probably be tested more frequently. I've talked with people who thought they were in monogamous relationships and they weren't. So you never know for sure who your partner's sleeping with. So I think it's prudent to just get tested on an annual basis, if you can. You know, we know that there's a lot of people in the United States, about 20%, who are infected with HIV that don't know they have the disease. So there's about 1.2 million people infected in the United States. That's an estimate, and 20% of them don't know they have it. And they're spreading the disease to other people.
Do we do, Tom Bartenbach, do we do enough with sort of condom distribution and other areas? We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jim who wanted me to ask that question.
We can always do more in terms of condom distribution and education and prevention, whether that's be with our kids or whether that be with schools, social organizations. There's always a lot more we can do to bring this to the people's attention. The complacency issue seems to have set in over the past decade, and I think that maybe that's got to do with something of the new medications that Dr. O can talk about. In fact, if you can expound a little bit more.
Well, and actually, I'd like to get to the complacency issue if we could. I mean, I have written a column where I point out that it's sort of what I call the Magic Johnson issue, it's been 20 years since he was diagnosed and he's still alive. The fact that he's a multimillionaire with access to the best medical care available anywhere on the planet doesn't seem to enter into the equation. It's that people think that because he's still alive, the crisis has passed. Is that part of the complacency issue there? And the fact that we have brought the numbers down, at least in this country.
Well, we've brought the AIDS numbers down. We haven't necessarily brought the HIV numbers down. Mm-hmm. People are still becoming infected. We're 25% over where we were in 2004 in terms of infected population.
And I should ask real quickly, because I know there are going to be people out there who do not understand this. Dr. Osterholzer, could you explain the difference between HIV and AIDS? I'm sorry to cut you off, Tom, but I think that's an important point.
Sure. Well, HIV is the virus that people acquire, and AIDS is more of a clinical category when someone's immune system becomes so debilitated that they become at risk for what we call AIDS-defining illnesses. Typically, we define AIDS in a person who has a CD4 count or a T-cell count, an immune system number count that's below 200, or that has acquired an infection or cancer that is considered an AIDS-defining illness. So we monitor people who have acquired HIV and then go on to progress to AIDS. That's reportable to the health department to try to track, how many people become positive and then go on to become classified as having AIDS.
We are talking about AIDS in Indiana to mark World AIDS Day here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Phil, all of that sounds pretty daunting. Could you talk a little bit, since you're the one who has to live with all of this, about what your challenge, what the biggest challenge is for you?
The biggest challenge for me, and I guess this changes according to where you are with this disease, but the biggest challenge for me has been disclosure. Mm-hmm. And I think a case of disclosure is closely related to education.
Making it people more comfortable with living with it.
If you disclose to someone that you're HIV infected, what's their reaction going to be? Are they going to run out the door? Are they going to put their arm around your shoulder and say, I understand? Or are they going to be critical? It's a very, very difficult thing, and it's closely tied to the education of the person who hears that disclosure.
And I'm going to ask a couple of questions here.
Sure.
Feel free not to answer them, because I do know you want to protect your anonymity here. So if I do anything that we think is going to disclose, actually— In terms of your profession, are you worried about professional consequences for disclosing? Or
no, I am. I'm actually semi-retired, so I guess that adds a little bit to my independence, if you will.
And being, are you worried about a sense of social isolation then? I mean, would your family reject you, do you think, or do you have surviving family?
Oh, yeah, I have children. I have three children, five grandchildren.
None of whom know about this?
None of whom know about this. It's ironic that I'm asked that question often and with some dismay. I'm not implying that you're dismayed at it. But
no, I'm not.
Most people are dismayed at it. And I guess I've reached the point where I'm comfortable with this disease as much as you can be. And so I feel that I can still be a person, an operating person in society, and I don't think that my family needs that worry.
Can I ask, this may be a very sensitive question, and I will understand and respect it if you can't answer. What is your prognosis right now?
Well, I'll just give you the words of my doctor. Phil, you're going to be a very, very old man.
Well, then that's good news.
I think
that's
it is.
Good news. Yeah, that's very good news. I want to switch subjects ever so slightly here, or switch tacks a little bit. We've gotten an email from Lisa Marshall, I think is the, I hope I'm pronouncing the last name right. basically, there's more jargon in here than I can probably wrap my tongue around safely. So I'm going to try to paraphrase it. She's really talking about the bad news from the Global Fund yesterday about, you know, really a constriction in the funding for AIDS treatment research and all of that. Tom Bartenbach, or Danielle Osterholzer, could you please tell me what the implications are there?
Well, certainly the HIV/AIDS epidemic is it's worst in sub-Saharan Africa and in other resource-limited settings. And, you know, we've made great strides there in treatment programs, but those programs take money. And with cuts in funding, it will be difficult, I think, to maintain all the treatment programs and scale up treatment programs that are necessary to, you know, prevent people in those areas from succumbing to the disease. So it's expensive to provide HIV care. And so I think cuts in funding are going to be detrimental to the fight against HIV globally.
How expensive?
Well, it depends on where you're providing care. Here in the United States, one of our typical antiretroviral regimens costs $2,000 a month if you pay for it out of your pocket. Most people don't because they can't afford it. It's estimated, and this is, I think, a low estimate, that it costs $300,000 to $400,000 over someone's lifetime to take care of them if they're HIV infected. Like I said, I think that's a low estimate. It's expensive disease because of the blood work, the medications that are required to keep the virus at bay.
And Phil, I'm going to ask them the basic question. I mean, it sounds like in addition to everything else, you got dumped with a huge load of expenses here.
Right.
Too. Do you have insurance that covers this, or somehow are you having to struggle to do this on your own?
No, I wouldn't say that I'm without assistance, but I am requiring much less assistance than most do.
And why is that?
Well, one, because Medicare takes care of a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
The other is that because of some supplementary programs that the state of Indiana has.
Now, and I'm going to shift over here and ask Tom Bartenbach in terms of providing the kind of assistance you do. Has your funding basically remained static through the years, grown, fallen? Is it easier to raise money now or harder to raise money?
It's definitely more difficult to raise money. Funding on a national level has remained almost level. We've always had threats of decreasing, whether it be from HUD or whether it be from Ryan White funding or from HRSA, Health and Human Services. I think locally, you know, we've had an amazing loyal donor base that has been at the plate with us since day one and continues to support us. But it's always been a struggle, not only from raising funds, but to do that education out there on the outreach side as well. You know, a lot of our clients that come into the center, while they're HIV positive, that's not necessarily the number one issue these days with the economy. We are providing 200,000 pounds of food out of our food pantry a year. We provide transportation, emergency funding to help folks with rent or utility payments around the course of the year when they get into trouble. We have, if you came into our lobby, you would notice a lot of toys over in the corner because we have so many children that come in whose parents are infected. You know,
we're all in children who are infected too, right? Sadly.
We're seeing a lot of populations that are becoming infected that don't know that they were at risk, particularly women of color who are, last year in Marion County, 33% of those that tested positive for HIV were already in the state of AIDS. So that means they've been carrying the disease for, or the virus for several years.
And if that's the case, if you're already in the state of AIDS, Dr. Osterholzer, what's the prognosis then? What's the life expectancy at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to quote a life expectancy, but, you know, it depends on what AIDS conditions you've acquired. Some there's no treatment for. Some improve with antiretroviral treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, when treated, the patient can still, what we call, kind of raise their counts up above the quote-unquote cutoff for AIDS. So patients who may maybe met the criteria for AIDS but who then got on treatment were able to raise their counts to the point where now they're not at risk for AIDS-defining conditions any longer. But it all depends on the illness that the patient's acquired. Certainly the longer your immune system has been devastated by AIDS or HIV, the much less likely it is to recover to a point where you're not going to acquire any more infections or illnesses related to AIDS.
We are talking about AIDS in Indiana to mark World AIDS Day here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Robbie who says, if we have reliable tests and understand how HIV is transmitted, why not aggressively test everyone to slow the epidemic? Who wants to take that one? Phil?
I see, please. No reason why we shouldn't. But the problem is, I think, again, is the education of people. Mm-hmm. They'll be very reluctant, and I think we'll have a lot of difficulty, be very reluctant to accept that situation.
Danielle, yes. Osterholzer.
Well, I certainly am a proponent of testing. I think that there's people who don't know they're at risk who are. I think it's impossible for physicians or other providers to gauge a person's risk when they come into the office. People don't necessarily share their risk behaviors with their physicians. Plus, a lot of people don't know they're at risk. I see many patients who I talk to who, when I ask them about their risk factors or their partners, really had no idea that they might be at risk for HIV and really were very shocked to be diagnosed with it. I think you should test people the way that it's recommended by the CDC, as I stated before. There certainly are higher risk populations that, should be probably targeted more effectively than they are now. But I think universal testing is probably the best way to try to uncover all these people that don't know they're infected.
Mm-hmm. Tom Bartenbach, should it be? I mean, it sounds like the implication here is that it ought to be legally mandated that you get tested. Is that...
Well, I think there's also the flip side of those doing the testing and the educators being educated around, particularly in the rural areas of the state, as to what that means when someone tests positive, what that means to them emotionally, mentally, as well as physically, and when, how to respond to that. And there's a lot of work being done in that area. But I certainly agree that testing is utmost importance, and the more people we can get into testing, the more people we can get into services. And once we get them into services, they are at a point where they are taking more care of themselves, I think, more direct involvement with their health, and become more aware of their partner and or anyone else they're having sex with.
Yes, Dr. Osterholzer.
I was going to say, your caller asked about reliable HIV testing. You know, there are a group of individuals out there who, when they become acutely infected with HIV, meaning they just acquired the infection, will not test positive with the standard HIV tests that we, offer people such at the Damien Center, et cetera. And so there really has been a push to heighten providers and physicians' recognition of what a patient looks like who has just acquired HIV infection. They typically have a flu-like illness or can, look like they have infections with many other things, but someone has to think of that.
We are talking about AIDS in Indiana today here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. We're talking with Tom Bartenbach, Danielle Osterholzer, and Phil. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about AIDS in Indiana with our guests, Dr. Danielle Osterholzer, faculty member with the IU School of Medicine and medical director of the Ryan White HIV Clinic at Wishart Hospital, Tom Bartenbach, who is the executive director of the Damien Center, and Phil, who is a volunteer and client at the Damien Center. I want to talk a little bit about whether it's a pretty bleak picture we've put out there so far, whether we have made any progress. And I guess I'm going to ask this in the context in terms of the stigma. I remember living in this state at the time that the whole Ryan White thing exploded. We've invoked his name, obviously, with the funding and care. And I remember, I mean, the response there at that time was just absolutely vitriolic. Is it quite that bad now? Tom Bartenbach.
Oh, we've come a long way since the days of Ryan White. I mean, there was a young man who taught us so much about HIV and about discrimination, about stigma, through his education of, of a 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just amazing. He was wise beyond his years. We have him to thank for a lot of where we're at today and that progress that we've made, educating each other about how the disease is contracted, what's safe, what's not.
Danielle Osterholzer.
I think we have come a long way, as Tom has stated, but, you know, I still think there's a long way to go. I still see patients. I take care of children with HIV infection also, and I still see kids who have their HIV disclosed at school who are discriminated against, who have to transfer schools, and not just discriminated against by classmates, but by adults. We don't advise our patients to disclose HIV to anybody that they don't fully trust and feel has their best interests at heart, because they still can be discriminated against in daycare centers, schools, churches, workplaces. So,
we've gotten an email question, I think, that fits in naturally here from Nancy Poor, who says, I'd like to know what percentage of new HIV cases are in the youth population, ages 15 to 30. I'm guessing it is higher than in older groups. Says, my concern is youth. They live in a media culture that is saturated with casual sexuality. We have little community dialogue and the importance of demanding proof that your prospective partner is not carrying the HIV virus. How can we create a coalition to present information to youth in a supportive and candid way? I'll start first with, what is the percentage in the youth population? And I see Dr. Osterholzer actually has her finger on a chart right there that has the number.
Accurate. Well, I figured someone might ask this, but, okay. You know, in Indiana, this is a spotlight report from the Indiana State Department of Health. In Indiana, 45% of HIV at first diagnosis was in individuals from age 20 to 29 in Indiana. People with AIDS at first diagnosis, 14%. So you can see a large percentage of the new cases occurring in the 20 to 29-year-old age range. We still see people being diagnosed at that age group. What I see in my clinic is that I see people who are diagnosed with HIV in their 20s, but they have AIDS already, or they mm-hmm. have severe immune suppression. That tells me they were infected when they were teenagers. So I think there's an underappreciation of the AIDS epidemic in teenagers and young adults. They are one of the rising, fastest groups acquiring HIV. I think they don't know who Ryan White is. They've not heard. They don't know the history of the HIV epidemic. They have complacency about the disease. As I said, it can be a chronic illness and can be treated. However, the stigma and the other things that go along with being infected are much different than having diabetes or another chronic illness. So I do think that education needs to be better. I don't know that the education that the kids receive these days in the public schools is necessarily adequate, or that the kids are paying attention.
How should we talk about all of this? I guess is the other way to cut through and consolidate these questions. Tom Bartenbach, how should we talk about it?
Well, I was just going to relay a quick story.
Sure.
Last year we had a 19-year-old come into the center and got tested, and he tested positive. The next day his mother came in with him to go through the intake to sign up with the care coordination staff and begin to get what services that we could provide. And as he went back with the care coordinator, his mom and I were just talking out in the lobby, and she said, didn't you guys used to be over on Pennsylvania? And I said, yeah, we did. And she said that her brother lived with her and died of AIDS and was one of our clients. And the day he died was the day her son was born. So that's how long we're into multi-generations now who have been infected with the disease. 40 or 60% of our clients are over 40 years old. that tells you that how they're living longer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that population that Dr. O just talked about in terms of the percentages that we're not getting to, that we're not reaching out and getting tested, that are not responding to the need to become tested. It's the complacency of youth. It's also the immortality of youth. It's been a tough population to reach. That's why we started the Teen Damien program last year.
Well, and I guess I want to reinforce this point because we keep hearing it here, and I want to drive that home. It sounds like it is really, really crucial to be tested early and often, right?
If yes. We're going to leave with a message here today.
Yeah, that's so, it. Yeah. That's it. Don't leave it to guesswork. Don't put it off. Don't put it aside. Phil, since you have lived with this, you said you would get yourself tested regularly. When did you start doing that? And what was the trigger that finally prompted you to go in and say, I'm going to do this?
It was, regrettably, I'm ashamed to admit it, after I got a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I was becoming more sexually active. And I don't mean that there's no difference, I don't think, when you're talking about HIV infection between being promiscuous one time a year versus 20 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I became more aware of it, and that's what prompted me to get tested more frequently.
Yeah, the cliche is it's not just the person you're sleeping with, but every other person.
Yeah,
person,
and I think one of the greatest fallacies is you can tell somebody's got HIV by looking at them.
Mm-hmm. And do you have some idea of how you were infected?
Yes.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Is it something you can share?
Probably not.
Okay. Okay, we also, Nancy had a second question, which is, should we require blood testing like we used to for venereal disease before people get married?
Well, I can answer or give my opinion on that. I think, you know, HIV, because of the stigma that it carries to this day, I think that it's going to be difficult to sign on to any mandated HIV testing program. I think most reasonable individuals, when it's discussed or presented to them by their providers, usually accept HIV testing. But I think if someone doesn't want to be tested, except for, you know, certain reasons where it can be mandated, I think in the general population, it's going to be a tough sell to mm-hmm. mandate that.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about AIDS in Indiana to mark World AIDS Day here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email. It looks like the one of the members of the Tom Bartenbach fan club here. A woman named Lisa Kaufman says, Tom Bartenbach has been a leader in HIV/AIDS in Indiana for 20 years. His ability to advocate and network nationally and locally has been transformative for service delivery in Indiana. So you're free to say thank you or blush if you would like to.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Yeah.
I appreciate those words.
But I guess where I would like to take that is ask both Dr. Osterholzer and Tom Bartenbach about what drew you to this work. I would think a lot of it has got to be somewhat bleak and depressing. I mean, there are not too many happy outcomes, right? So could we talk a little bit about that? I'll start with you, Dr. Osterholzer.
Sure. Well, I find the disease, you know, fascinating in general. But I also, it's one of those, and I'm an infectious disease specialist, so it's an infectious disease that we can't cure, but we can make people feel much better and do much better. And so it's enjoyable to me to take a patient who, you know, has a high viral load, they're recently diagnosed, they're in despair, and to be able to show them that, you know, they can take medications, they can be healthy, and to get that person back to a reasonable state of health, I think that's very satisfying. Certainly there are situations where, you know, we struggle and patients don't do well, but I think the patients that do succeed, you know, outweigh that. And so it's not as bleak, I don't think, as it used to be. And so that's what's drawn me to continue to be a part of it.
Tom Bartenbach, what drew you to this?
Well, quite frankly, my friends were dying. Mm-hmm. I probably attended more funerals as a 35-year-old than I may when I'm going to be 65.
Mm-hmm.
I lost a lot of people in a very awful, excruciating, painful death. Wasting is horrific in its basics. I mean, it is something that I feel being able to do this work so thankful mm-hmm. and so honored that then I can actually feel good about providing assistance to people on a daily basis. In my own personal career path, I've gone back and forth from the private sector of owning my own business to working in not-for-profits, and I have to tell you, there's nothing like it. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a volunteer or a staff, being able to give back to society makes it worth living.
Because you owned a chain of grocery stores, right?
Well, there were two.
Two. Well, yeah. that qualifies as a chain.
It was a chain to me.
It was a chain. But I guess what I'm saying is you had a successful business career. What was the moment like when you said, I got to give this up and, give up my business career and I really need to get into this fight?
It was very introspective, obviously. Mm-hmm. It was a moment of a complete shift in mindset, mind values, mind goals. As an entrepreneur, there's that strive to be successful, to be driven, to raise money, mm-hmm. Personal money. And this just blew all that out of the water. I mean, it actually put a value on other human life that I felt good about, that I felt good about helping people.
Are there ever
moments? It was an epiphany.
Yeah. Are there ever moments when you say, oh, man, I can't take this anymore. I'd rather just go back and worry about the balance sheet at the end of the day, and that's it.
Yesterday.
And maybe today at the end.
Yeah. It's just one of those things you just keep plugging at. It's a lot of there's so much emotion around this topic. It can become a very an issue that becomes extremely volatile mm-hmm. When we're talking about death, dying. Mm-hmm. Disease, infection. Mm-hmm. There's a limited amount of resources. There's a limited amount of folks willing to come to the table, whether that be private funders. Fortunately, we have wonderful people here in town that have been here from the beginning, such as Betty Wilson with the Health Foundation Greater Indianapolis. She is. Mm-hmm. Gone above and beyond the call of duty when it comes to this topic. But yes, it can be very frustrating. It can mm-hmm. be horribly frustrating. Mm-hmm. But the people that work in the field are extremely compassionate, and that makes it all. I tend to bring what I feel is the analytical side sometimes.
Okay. And yeah, Phil, I would like to ask real quickly, since mm-hmm. you're the one who lives with this experience directly, could you talk to people who have friends, loved ones, or whatever, who have HIV? What can they do that would most help? What's the gesture or whatever that says the most?
The first thing I usually tell people when I disclose to them my HIV status is, oh, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. And my response to them usually is, I don't want your sympathy, I want your support. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would tell people to wrap your arms around that person and just say, that's all right, I'm still your friend.
And that's it.
That's all you have to do.
We have got just about a minute left, and I want to, this is a sweeping question, but if one practical thing we could do right now as a society to make a dent in this problem, what would it be, Dr. Osterholzer?
I think testing. If I had to say one thing, I'd say people who are tested and know their status are less likely to transmit the infection.
And give them a place real quickly that they can go do that.
Well, certainly Damien Center is one of them. People can get tested through their local physician's office, providers. Wishard actually has a rapid testing program in the emergency room for people who come there to be seen for other things or tested for HIV. There's plenty of places throughout the city and where you can go to become, you know, be tested for HIV. Bellflower, STD clinic. Mm-hmm. The tests are out there if people want them.
Okay. Tom Bartenbach, one concrete thing we could do.
I'd have to agree with Dr. O, testing. You could also go to Moan on Coffee today or just pop in. They are doing promotions for the Damien Center for World AIDS Day.
Okay, Phil, real quick.
My answer would be three words, education.
I want to thank you all for joining us today. Tom Bartenbach, Executive Director of the Damien Center, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
Dr. Danielle Osterholzer, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Phil, I particularly want to thank you for sharing your story
with us. Thanks for listening.
I think that's a courageous thing to do. We have been talking today about World AIDS Day. Next week, we are going to be back, and we will be talking about holiday shopping and computer problems. It's quite a shift for us. What I would like for you to do in these last few seconds that we are here, and you are listening to me, is to think a bit about how much better the world would be if all the people we have not lost to this disease were still with us. I'm John Kroll. I'll see you next week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.